the size of the congregation today reminds me of a story about the young pastor who was very anxious to please his congregation. And then a big snowstorm came up, and it turns out that there was only one person who came to services. It was an old farmer, and the young pastor was very nervous. And he thought, well, I really didn't know what to do. So he thought, well, I'll just pretend everything is perfectly normal. And he gave a real stem winder of a sermon and just really gave it to him. And afterwards, he asked the one congregant, well, what did you think? How was it? And the old farmer says, well, he said, when I go out to feed the cows and only one cow comes up to eat, I don't feed them the whole load of hay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm afraid you're going to get the whole load of hay today. Dr. Walter Williams, a professor of economics at a university on the East Coast, noted that for thousands of years, that the way to become wealthy, the way of man, was to take it from other people by force, by some kind of force or power. And yet in the last several hundred years in America, the great American experiment, that with the free market system in America, the way to wealth was to be of service to other people. There was a remark that was made by another economist, and I want to quote this remark, named Arthur Brooks. From the time of Pericles, now I want to do an inset here. Pericles was a Greek statesman. He was an orator and an Athenian general who lived in Greece from about 495 BC to 429 BC. He was an important general in Greece in the wars between Greece and Persia. And so from the time of Pericles until the end of the 18th century in London, 2300 years, the standards of living on earth increased perhaps about 100%. In the United States in 1790, by contrast, real per capita gross domestic product has increased nearly 4,000%. Quality of life, in other words, increased 40 times more in 220 years of American history than it had globally over 2,000 years. In 2012, a typical American in the bottom fifth of the income distribution has a far higher quality of life and life expectancy than the average member of the top 1% in 1790. It's really rather remarkable, the development of how things have changed in world history, on how the use of certain factors or functions or features of our economy has changed America in comparison to the history of the world. Let's consider four gasoline stations at one intersection. One gas station has the lowest price. The second gas station has the best service because it has the best traffic pattern with easy-to-operate modern gas pumps. The third gas station has the best selection of convenience store products, and the fourth gas station has a fast food outlet with a drive-up window attached to the store. All four businesses sell gasoline, but each one has a different emphasis to keep them attractive to customers and be competitive with other gas stations. And because all four gas stations are located near each other, customers from far and wide know they can get gas when they come to that location. So you find here an example of the competitive forces of the free market. Today I'm going to look at the subject of cooperation and competition, and then examine the Bible for positive and negative examples of cooperation and competition. Some people want to set up a supposed conflict between cooperation and competition as if those two principles are polar opposites, and then condemn competition as being ungodly while holding up cooperation as being godly. So we'll examine the biblical references to see if there really is a biblical command to embrace one concept over the other, and how our understanding of these principles may be important in our personal lives. You might title this message Competition and Cooperation. First, a look at the definition of cooperation. According to Merriam-Webster's dictionary, there are two definitions. Number one, the act of cooperating, a common effort. Or number two, the association of persons for common benefit. The number two definition, association of persons for common benefit, I picked up on that quick. I'm a member of several co-ops. One is my electricity provider. Several more co-ops are farm supply and farm service co-ops. Some of us perhaps may belong to a natural food co-op. The word co-op is a shortened version of the word cooperative, and a cooperative is a company that's formed by people for a common purpose, and each member may own stock in a co-op, and they get to vote on the board of directors who oversees the company. And then co-op members frequently get to purchase items or services at an advantaged price through the co-op. If we take a look in the Bible under cooperation, we can find some significant examples, in fact, outstanding examples of cooperation, of what really worked well, the number one definition, the action of cooperating or of a common effort. We can read that in Genesis 5, and if we start it, and I just want to note one verse in Genesis 5:32, because this first example, a positive example of cooperation, and I'll label it 1A for those of you that like notes in outline form. Noah and his sons building the ark. In Genesis 5:32, Noah had three sons at age 500. And so if we read that, and Noah was 500 years old, and Noah begat Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now, not too many of us have made it to 500, much less had children at that age. But people lived longer at that time. Noah did. If we jump down to Genesis 6, and we'll look starting in verse 9, this is the genealogy of Noah. Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations, and Noah walked with God, verse 10, and Noah begat three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. In verse 11, the earth was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence, so God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. Verse 13, and God said to Noah, now here's the instructions. The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them and the earth. Make yourself an ark of gopher wood, make rooms in the ark, and cover it inside and outside with pitch, and this is how you shall make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, its height 30 cubits. You shall make a window for the ark, you shall finish it to a cubit from above, and set the door of the ark in its side. You shall make it with a lower, second, and third decks, and behold, I myself am bringing floodwaters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh which is in the breath, in which is the breath of life. Everything that is on the earth shall die, but I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing, all flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you, and they shall be male and female, of the birds after their kind, of animals after their kind, and of every creeping thing on the earth after its kind. Two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive, and you shall take for yourself all food that is eaten, and shall gather it to yourself, and it shall be food for you and for them. So I want you to think about this for a moment. God assigned a monumental task to Noah to do something that had never been done before. God gave Noah specific instructions regarding the project, the measurement, the types of wood, and how to make it, how to make it watertight, to put in a door and a window, three decks. He instructed how many of what kind of animals to bring. And that brings us to Genesis chapter 6, verse 22. And what did Noah do? In Genesis 6:22, thus Noah did all according to all that God commanded him, so he did. The ark was over 600 feet long. I remember as a teenager trying to figure out how long that was. On the farm, we had a driveway that was pretty close to that 600 feet long, and we measured it all out and spaced out and put on the ground the size of the ark. So we could tell that it was one huge thing to build for only four men and four women to build. The timbers had to be cut from a forest and transported to the building site. Well, how do you cut down a tree without tools? Noah and his sons either had to purchase the tools or to barter for the tools, the axes, the saws, the planes, or Noah and his sons had to make the tools themselves. If they had to make their own tools, then Noah and his sons would have had to have mined the ore, smelt the ore into metal, and then shaped the metal into the desired tools. If Noah bartered for the tools, he would have had to have been engaged in some enterprise in order to trade something of value to obtain the tools. Once the trees were in the forest and they were felled, how did they get to the building site? Did Noah use oxen, horses, or elephants, or some other beast of burden? We don't know the particulars, but we do know that it takes a lot of hay to feed oxen and horses and elephants. We know it takes time to design and make the harnesses. We know it took time and expertise to train the beasts of burden to effectively assist Noah and his sons. After the trees were felled, hauled to the building site and manufactured into lumber that could be used to build an ark, Noah's crew still had to figure out how to prop up the timbers and fasten them together into a framework that resembled a ship, an ark. One man simply could not accomplish these tasks. It took a team, and this team worked for 100 years to accomplish the task. What brought to my mind was my great-grandfather, who was a pioneer in the late 1800s. He was homesteading on the Minnesota prairie, and he had to build his own buildings. He had to dig his own wells, he had to build his own fences and roadways. There was no hardware store, no Lowe's or Home Depot as a building center to supply his needs. He had to barter or purchase the tools made elsewhere and then build everything himself. The barn on the family homestead is called a basement barn. It was dug into the side of a hill. Three sides of the basement barn were then had stone and mortar walls, and the fourth side of the barn was like a walkout basement. The basement barn kept the livestock because it was built into the hillside. It kept them warmer in the winter and cooler in the summer. Well, to get the lumber to build that barn and the haymow above it, my great-grandfather purchased the trees on about 40 acres, about 10 miles away. He diligently felled the trees, turned the trees into lumber, and built the haymow on top of his basement barn. But my great-grandfather didn't build the barn all by himself. He built the side walls and the rafters with the lumber spread out on the flat ground. Then all of the neighbors came together for a barn raising. It was a big event. They used horses and pulleys to raise the walls up into place. They used large wooden pegs that were hammered into pre-drilled holes to hold the superstructure together. Neighbor farmers and their wives came from miles around on wagons and horses to make a day of it. At the end of the day, there was a big celebration, a big feast and a barn dance on the newly constructed barn's haymow floor. In fact, the barn is still there. You can go and you can see the beams, the timbers, the round pegs that were put through the holes, what holds it all together. It was over 60 years later, when I was just a boy, an old neighbor farmer told me about the event. He was an old man at the time, and I was just a young kid, but he said that he played the fiddle for the barn dance. He and two other musicians sat on top of the water tank. They had brought in redwood, which rots very slowly, resists rotting, and they had made a water tank up in the hay barn so gravity flow to the livestock underneath, and they put it in the haymow, and the musicians sat on top of that water tank and played the music. I could see the emotion in the old man's voice as he relived the moment. He told me he didn't much like playing the fiddle and watching somebody else dance with his girl. Apparently that was pretty important to him some 60 years later. But everyone else in the community was cooperated with each other in helping each other, building barns, building houses, assisting when needed, were harvesting the crops, and yet everyone had his own property, his own farming enterprise. And some people prospered more than others, because it was depending upon their management ability. But back to Genesis and Noah. In Genesis 7, verse 7, we read the culmination of the building of that ark. in Genesis 7:7, Noah and his family entered the ark when Noah was 600 years old. And then the flood came. Well, this was teamwork. Noah's family had cooperated to accomplish a huge task. They kept their eyes on the goal to complete the objectives before them despite the obstacles. This may be one of the best examples of cooperation in the history of mankind, with the same people cooperating in one family, working together for 100 years on the same overall objective. There's another example of cooperation in the Bible. I'll label this 1B. It's Abraham and Lot, who parted ways to keep the peace. We read this story in Genesis 13. The patriarch Abraham had moved from Haran, which is in Syria, down to Canaan, and he brought along his nephew Lot, his deceased brother's son, because he was now responsible for Lot, and his nephew had inherited his own father's estate. Both Abraham and Lot had men working for them to care for their thousands of head of livestock. And as we read in Genesis 13, the employees of Abraham began to fight with the employees of Lot over the use of wells to water the livestock. In Genesis 13:1, and Abram, who was later called Abraham, went up from Egypt, and he and his wife and all that he had and Lot with him, to the south. And Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver and in gold, and he went on in his journey from the south as far as Bethel, to the place where his tent had been at the beginning between Bethel and Ai, to the place of the altar which he had made there at first, which I believe was the location where he had offered Isaac a sacrifice. And there Abram called on the name of the Lord. Verse 5, and Lot also, who went with Abram, had flocks and herds and tents. Now the land was not able to support them, that they might dwell together, for their possession was so great they could not dwell together. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. The Canaanites and the Perizzites also then dwelt in the land. Verse 8, so Abram said to Lot, please, let there be no strife between you and me, and between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we're brethren. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If you take the left, then I will go to the right. If you go to the right, then I will go to the left. Well, as a result, Abraham and Lot resolved the issue peaceably. They agreed to part ways so that they and their employees would not fight, and there would be plenty of room for the herds and flocks for both Abraham and Lot. Abraham and Lot cooperated in solving a problem, and there was peace between them as a result. The third example, I label it 1C, was Boaz leaving the corner of his fields for gleaners. Many years later, during the time of the judges, the Israelites had returned after 400 years in Egypt and had resettled the land that God had given to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And certain rules were put in place to provide assistance for those who were unable to farm their own land. And we read that in Leviticus 19 and verse 9, and Leviticus 19:9. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest. And this is repeated then in Leviticus 23:22. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field when you reap, nor shall you gather any gleaning from your harvest. You shall leave them for the poor and for the stranger. I am the Lord your God. Well, this is how people who were unable to plant a crop and own property, they could still survive. They could harvest the corners of the fields that were left unharvested, especially for that purpose. When the widow Ruth and her widowed mother-in-law Naomi returned to Bethlehem area, the ancestral home of Naomi's husband Elimelech, they had been gone many years to the country of Moab, but both widows now had no means of support. They didn't get Social Security checks. They didn't have food stamps, Medicaid, or utility assistance. Accordingly, they took advantage of the gleaning opportunity offered to them, as outlined as we read in Leviticus 23:22. And the landowners there generally followed God's instructions on how to provide for those who could not provide for themselves. We read about Naomi's and Ruth's gleaning experience in the book of Ruth in chapter 2, starting in verse 1. There was a relative of Naomi's husband, a man of great wealth of the family of Elimelech. His name was Boaz. So Ruth, the Moabitess, said to Naomi, "Please let me go to the field and glean heads of grain after him in whose sight I might find favor." And she, meaning Naomi, said to her, "Ruth, go, my daughter." Then she left Ruth and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. So Ruth was taking advantage of this opportunity to go out and glean, to pick up what was left of the crop after the harvesters came through. Now Boaz, in chapter 2, in verse 14, Boaz said to her at mealtime, because they had gathered together to eat a meal in common, "Come here and eat the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar and the sop," which was a dietary custom. So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed parched grain, cooked grain, to her, and she ate and was satisfied and kept some back, meaning for her mother-in-law. And when she rose up to glean, Boaz commanded his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. Also let grain from the bundles fall purposefully for her. Leave her that she may glean, and do not rebuke her." Well, Boaz was saying, well, yeah, she's out there gleaning, but we'll make sure she gets a little extra, because after all, she had a fondness in his eye, he had a fondness for her in his eye, and he knew that she not only had to provide for herself, but for her widowed mother-in-law as well. So in this case, the landowner Boaz noticed that Ruth was gleaning in the fields and told his employees, leave a little extra for her beyond that which was ordinarily left in the corners of the field, so that Ruth could get a good supply of grain to support her and Naomi. You see, Boaz was cooperating with the law of the land, the method by which God had laid out the instructions that we read in Leviticus 19 and 22, to provide for the widows by allowing the widows to harvest the corners of his fields. And Boaz's workers cooperated in leaving the unharvested grain a little extra for Ruth to pick up. Boaz could have kept the grain for himself, or his workers could have kept the grain for themselves, but they chose to work together to make sure there was plenty of grain for Ruth to glean and to take home to her mother-in-law. Ruth did not push herself into abusing the privileges afforded to her, but she gleaned from the corners of the field whatever the harvest left behind. There's a fourth example in the Bible, and there are probably many, many more, and I'm labeling this 1D if you're writing an outline. And this is where the disciples were casting their nets. They were fishing as a team effort. Ordinarily, we think of fishing as a solitary occupation. This is because we envision fishermen with a pole and a fishing line and a hook, perhaps with some bait. But historically, many fishermen used nets to catch fish, many fish at one time. Well, the disciples of Jesus Christ, who were fishermen, had to work together to cast the nets and gather the fish. We read in Mark 1, and in verse 16, in Mark 1:16, "And as he," meaning Christ, "walked by the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. Then Jesus said to them, 'Follow me, and I will make you become fishers of men.' They immediately left their nets and followed him." Simon and Andrew were working together, using a net to gather fish. They understood the critical importance of working together. And Christ saw the spirit of cooperation in them and called Simon and Andrew to join his work to become fishers of men. This is also an example for us to follow. Just as Jesus spoke of in Mark 1, we must work together to become fishers of men. And thankfully, we have a peaceful, cooperative church that's populated with peaceful, cooperative people who are called by God to do his work. Working together cooperatively is an expectation of God. Well, that's four examples of positive cooperation. However, the Bible records a number of negative examples of cooperation. And I'll label this 2A, negative examples of cooperation. And this is the 10 brothers of Joseph conspire against him. We read in Genesis 37 about Joseph and his brothers. And in Genesis 37, verse 18, the brothers of Joseph were tired of Joseph's dreams. And so in verse 18, and when they, the brothers, saw him afar off, even before he came near to them, they conspired against him to slay him. So they were discussing how they could kill their own brother. So the animosity ran great. So here were the 10 sons of Joseph, who was later renamed Israel, who despised their younger brother Joseph. So they plotted together to how to get rid of Joseph, the 10 sons of Jacob. In Genesis 37, verse 23, so it came to pass, when Joseph had come to his brothers, that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. Then they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty, and there was no water in it. And skipping to, and then verse 25, and they sat down to eat a meal, and they lifted their eyes, and look, and there was a company of Ishmaelites, cousins, coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing spices and balm and myrrh on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, what profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. Let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother in our flesh. And his brothers listened. Now, I might note that Ishmael was the brother of Isaac, a half-brother of Isaac, which would be their grandfather's half-brother, and he had a number of sons, Ishmael did, and then grandsons. So these would be second cousins and third cousins, the Ishmaelites, from Midian. Then verse 28, the Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up, lifted him out of the pit, and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. So we have this example of the conspiratorial plotting of 10 brothers as a negative example of cooperation. So we know that all cooperation is not good. There's another example in the Bible, a significant example, and I'll label it number 2B, the rebellion against Moses' leadership by Korah, Dathan, and Abiram and others. This event occurred during the 40 years while the children of Israel were wandering in the desert after their exodus from Egypt. They had rejected the opportunity to retake the land of Canaan, the promised land, because they were afraid. They were weary in the wilderness as they were wandering, and they complained and they wished to question the authority of Moses. In Numbers 16, verse 1. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, the sons of Reuben, took men. And they rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel. Now, note the number here. 250 leaders of the congregation, representatives of the congregation, men of renown. Verse 3, they gathered together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, you take too much upon yourselves, for all the congregation is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Lord? 250 leaders is not a small number. They had gotten together. They had cooperated with each other, bolstering each other's complaints to become accusers of Moses and Aaron. God was not pleased. If we look at number 16 down in verse 20, in number 16, verse 20, we'll see what God's response was. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, separate yourselves from among the congregation, that I may consume them in a moment. Verse 22, and they fell on their faces and said, O God, the God of spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin, and you be angry with all the congregation? And the Lord said to Moses, speak to the congregation, saying, get away from the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Verse 25, and Moses rose and went to Dathan and Abiram, and the elders of Israel followed him. And he spoke to the congregation, saying, depart now from the tents of these wicked men. Touch nothing of theirs, lest you be consumed in all their sins. Verse 27, so they got away from around the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Dathan and Abiram came out and stood at the door of their tents. Note, And then what does it say? With their wives, their sons, and their little children. Verse 31, now it came to pass, as he finished speaking all these words, that the ground split apart under them, and the earth opened up its mouth and swallowed them up, and their households, and all the men with Korah and all their goods. And so all them that were with them went down into the pit, and the earth closed over them, and they perished from among the assembly. Then all Israel who were around them fled at their cry, and they said, lest the earth swallow us up also. Verse 35, and a fire came from the Eternal and consumed the 250 men who were offering incense. Well, clearly, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, as well as the 250 leaders and their families, who were cooperating with each other in their desire to unseat Moses, then met with an untimely end. There's another example of cooperation that did not turn out well. For those who have a negative cooperation, I'll label that 2C. And this is about Nehemiah's enemies, Sanballat, Tobias, and Geshem. You see, about 400 years after the tribes of Israel were carried into captivity, after about 400 years of being in the Promised Land, they were carried into captivity by their enemies, and the northern kingdom was carried off by Assyria, and the southern kingdom of Judah was marched off to Babylon by King Nebuchadnezzar. The Babylonian king allowed his Jewish cupbearer and wine taster Nehemiah to return to the land of Judah and become the governor. Nehemiah had in mind to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, and he convinced the king to let him do so. But Nehemiah had no end of trouble from his local enemies who didn't want Nehemiah to rebuild the walls of the city of Jerusalem. The three principal enemies, Sanballat, Tobias, and Geshem, attempted repeatedly to frustrate the Jews in rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. We read about it in Nehemiah 4, starting in verse 7. In Nehemiah 4, and verse 7, now it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, and the Arabs, and Ammonites, and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored, and the gaps were beginning to be closed, they became very angry. All of them conspired together to come and attack Jerusalem and create confusion. Nevertheless, and this is Nehemiah writing, we made our prayer to our God, and because of them, the enemies, we set a watch against them day and night. Verse 10, then Judah said, the tribe of Judah, the strength of the laborers is failing, and there is much rubbish that we are so much rubbish we're not able to build the wall. Things look pretty hard. They didn't have the materials they needed. There was a lot of work to be done. The enemies were about them trying to frustrate it. Now on to verse 11, Nehemiah 4:11. And our adversaries said, they will neither know nor see anything till we come in their midst and kill them and cause the work to cease. So their enemies wanting to do surprise attacks and come right in and kill them and stop them from building the wall. So verse 12, so it was when the Jews who dwelt near them came, they told us 10 times, from whatever place you turn, they will be upon us. Verse 13, therefore, meaning Nehemiah was talking, I positioned men behind the lower parts of the wall at the openings. I set the men according to their families with their swords, their spears, and their bows. And I looked and arose and said to the nobles, to the leaders, to the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Eternal, great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. Verse 15, and it happened when our enemies heard that it was known to us. In other words, it wasn't a surprise anymore that God had brought their plot to nothing, and that all of us returned to the wall, everyone to his work. So it was from that time on that half of my servants worked at construction while the other half held spears and shields and bows and wore armor, and the leaders were behind all of the house of Judah. Those who built the wall and those who carried burdens loaded themselves so that with one hand they worked on construction and with the other held a weapon. Every one of the builders had his sword girded at his side as he built, and the one who sounded the trumpet was beside me. So there's an example of cooperation among the group of Jews under Nehemiah, and as a positive sign in defending Jerusalem, and negative cooperation on the part of Sanballat, Tobiah, and the others who were enemies, who were conspiring and trying to kill them to prevent the wall from coming. These enemies of Judah cooperated in their attempts to stop Nehemiah's efforts. They lied about Nehemiah, they fought battles against him, and Nehemiah had to withstand the negative cooperation of his enemies. We've seen now some of the positive examples of cooperation. We talked about Noah and his sons, Abraham and Lot parting ways to keep peace, Boaz leaving the corners of the fields for the gleaners, and the disciples casting their nets, fishing as a team effort. For cooperation involved in doing the work that God had set before certain parties was what God expected, and the people were rewarded for their positive cooperation. We've also seen examples of negative cooperation, the kind of cooperation where people worked against those who would be used by God to accomplish a good work. There were the 10 brothers of Joseph who conspired against him. There was the rebellion against Moses and Aaron's leadership by Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, and 250 elders. And then there were Nehemiah's enemies, Sanballat, Tobias, and Geshem, and others. And as we've seen how the negative cooperation came to no good end for those who conspired against God and his servants. Now let's take a look at competition. And first of all, we'll start with a definition, again by Merriam-Webster's dictionary. There are two definitions: the act or process of competing, as in rivalry, which the sub-definitions are the efforts of two or more parties acting independently to secure the business of a third party by offering the most favorable terms. Or the second part of that is an active demand by two or more organisms, this is more in science, or kinds of organisms for some kind of environmental resource in short supply. And then there's another kind of, the second definition of competition is a contest between rivals. Well, let's take a look at those. The effort of two or more parties acting independently to secure the business of a third party. This is probably what we think of often as we see two different businesses or more competing for your business. You get advertisements in the mail and so forth. They're trying to get your business, seeing which one can give you the favorable terms. No payments, no interest, super duper deal on President's Day or Labor Day sale coming up, and you see all those efforts. So in some ways, that's the process of competing or a contest between rivals. And then there's the biological one, or the scientific definition of two organisms demanding the same thing. And I thought of fox and coyote, both after the rabbit. And so depends upon who's going to get the rabbit first. Is it going to be the fox, or is it going to be the coyote? So the coyote and the fox would be considered competitors for the same kind of food source. Well, the Bible gives us negative examples of competition. And it gives us several interesting examples in ways that we, and some uncomfortable examples. And so I'm going to label this one, this is the third point under negative examples of competition. I'm going to label this one 3A on my outline. I'm going to say 3A is Leah and Rachel were competing to have children. In Genesis 30, in verse 1, now, this is the case where Jacob was tricked, wound up marrying the sister that he didn't anticipate, found out the next day, and wound up with two wives. And so there was a competition between the wives to have children. And interestingly enough, the older sister, who was the first wife, Leah, had four sons. And so we go to Genesis 30, and we read on now of what happens from that point, and Rachel had no children. In Genesis 30 in verse 1. Now, at that time, as fact throughout history, having children was absolutely essential because that was your social security. That was your opportunity to do well in life. The more children you had, the more opportunities you had to gain family wealth and security and more protection and defense. In Genesis 30 and verse 1, "Now when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children," so this was the childless sister, "Rachel envied her sister," meaning Leah, "and said to Jacob, 'Give me children or else I die.'" And verse 2, "And Jacob's anger was aroused against Rachel, and he said, 'Am I in place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of your womb?' So she said, 'Here's my maid Bilhah, go to her, and she will bear a child on my knees, that I may also have children by her.'" In other words, "Make my servant Bilhah your wife, and then any children she has will be credited to me, because I am her master." And so she gave him Bilhah, her maid, as wife, and Jacob went in, and Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. And Jacob and Rachel said, "Aha, well now she legally has a son. God has judged my case," this is what she's saying, "and has heard my voice and gave me a son, even though it was by her efforts. Therefore she called his name Dan, and Rachel's maid Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. And Rachel said, 'With these great wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister, and indeed have prevailed.'" So now she has two sons. Verse 9, "When Leah saw that she had stopped bearing," well, she had already had four children, and now she, for some reason she wasn't having any more children, "she took Zilpah, her maid," well, she saw what her sister did, well, two can play this kind of game, "and she took Zilpah, her maid, and gave her to Jacob, his wife, and Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a son. And Leah said, 'A troop comes.' She called his name Gad, and Leah's maid Zilpah bore Jacob a second son." So now Jacob, Leah says, well, basically she's got two sons by her servant's servant and four of her own sons. Then Leah says, "I'm happy, for the daughters will call me blessed." She's going to get daughters-in-law. And she called his name Asher. So now legally she had six sons. So you find this contest going back and forth between sisters, this rivalry. And as we read about, and we already read somewhat about how the sons of Jacob had great rivalry against Joseph, and it didn't have a very, that was an example of negative cooperation that we've already read about. In other words, there were problems created because of the disunity and the disharmony in the family. So we could call that one a negative example of competition, where they were competing to have children, all for the wrong reasons. Now, in my outline, I have 3B, another example of negative cooperation. And this is where we take a look at the succession to King David's throne. We take a look at the grasping that occurred and the struggles that occurred as David's sons, some of his sons, competed for the throne and what the results of that were. And in 2 Samuel 15, in verse 1, now, before this time, I'll go and do the backstory before we go into 2 Samuel 15:1. Absalom had killed his brother Amnon because his brother had raped Absalom's sister Tamar. And this was a very sad circumstance. It was an unfortunate. And Absalom took his sister into his own household and said, basically, "Don't worry about it, I'll take care of things." And Absalom waited his time. And after some years, saw to the murder of his half-brother. And then he left. His mother was a princess from another land, and so he went to his mother's side of the family and stayed there for 3 years. And his father, King David, asked him at some point, "You know, would you come back? But if you do come back, I don't want to see you, but you can come back because you killed your brother." Well, Absalom came back, and in 2 Samuel 15, verse 1, we pick up the story. "After this happened, Absalom provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. Now Absalom would rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. And so it was, whenever anyone who had a lawsuit came to the king for a decision, that Absalom would call to him and say, 'What city are you from?' And he would say, 'Your servant is from such and such a tribe of Israel.' And Absalom would say to him, 'Look, your case is good and right, but there's no deputy of the king to hear you. Moreover, Absalom would say, oh, that I were made a judge in the land, and everyone who has any suit or cause would come to me, then I would give him justice. And so it was, whenever anyone came near to bow down to him, that he would put out his hand and take him and kiss him. And in this manner Absalom acted toward all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. Absalom put himself forward as an heir apparent, as a king, a would-be judge, and put himself and says, oh, you really, you know, I'll be your arbiter. I can make these kinds of decisions. I can help solve these problems or disputes. So he was already competing against his own father for the kingship. He had already killed his older brother, which would have stood in the way of being king. And now he was working to an attempt to usurp his father. Well, as time went on, he did in fact usurp his father's throne for a short while, or there was a and King David went to Hebron for 7 years. There was much ado and a problem there. And later Absalom met no good end as he was killed. The next one of David's sons thought it. He was the next elder son, so he thought he ought to be king. And David was old at the time. And so let's turn to 1 Kings in 1 Kings 1 and verse 5. In 1 Kings 1 and verse 5. And so here's another negative example of competition, where he was going to best his brothers and his father, for that matter, and try to get for himself the throne. In 1 Kings 1 and verse 5, then Adonijah exalted himself, saying, I will be king. And he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. Seems to me to be a pattern here. Must be that's what the king did in those days, is you had a security guard around you, you surrounded yourself with people to make yourself look important, and perhaps properly so, because there were people who would just as soon kill as not. So he surrounded himself with men. And his father had not rebuked him at any time by saying, why have you done so? Well, his father was very old at that time, King David was. He was also very good looking. His mother had borne him after Absalom. So, just as Absalom thought that he ought to be king, and Absalom was now dead, so did Adonijah. Then he, Adonijah, conferred with Joab, the son of Zerah, and with Abiathar the priest, and they followed and helped Adonijah. So we have a little negative cooperation going on here between the head of the army and the chief priest. But there was a number of others who weren't involved in that meeting, and we read about that in verse 8. But Zadok the priest, Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, and Nathan the prophet, Shimei, Rei, and the mighty men who belonged to David were not with Adonijah. So Adonijah had his own thing going here. He was putting things together so that he could be the king. After all, you know, he exalted himself saying, I will be the king. And then verse 9, Adonijah sacrificed sheep and oxen and fattened cattle, which is and invited his brothers, the king's son, and all the men of Judah, the king's servants. But he didn't invite, and who didn't he invite? Nathan the prophet, Benaiah, the mighty men, or Solomon, his brother. So verse 11, Nathan spoke to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, have you not heard that Adonijah, the son of Haggith, has become king, and that David, our Lord, doesn't know it? Come, please, let me now give you advice that you may save your own life and the life of your son Solomon. Go immediately to King David and say to him, Did you not, my lord, O king, swear to your maidservant, saying, assuredly your son Solomon shall reign after me, and he shall sit on my throne. Why then has Adonijah become king? Nathan is instructing her this. And then, while you're still talking with the king, I will come in after you and confirm your words. Verse 15, so Bathsheba went to the king, chamber of the king, and the king was very old. And verse 17, and she said, My Lord, you swore by the Lord your God to your maidservant, saying, Assuredly, Solomon shall reign, your son shall reign after me, and he shall sit on my throne. But look, Adonijah has become king, and now, my Lord the king, you do not even know about it. He, meaning Adonijah, sacrificed oxen and cattle and sheep in abundance, has invited all the sons of the king, Abiathar the priest, and Joab the commander of the army, but Solomon your servant, he's not invited. And as for you, my lord, O king, the eyes of all Israel are on you, and you should tell them who will sit on the throne of my lord the king after him. Otherwise it will happen when my lord the king rests with his fathers, meaning when he dies, that I and my son Solomon will be counted as offenders, meaning they will lose their lives as a threat to the throne. And the verses on, just as Nathan the prophet said, he came in and confirmed her words. So verse 28, and King David said, Call Bathsheba to me, and she came to the king's presence. And the king took an oath and said, As the Lord lives, he who has redeemed my life from every distress, just as I swore to you by the Lord God of Israel, saying, Assuredly Solomon your son shall be king after me. He shall sit on my throne in my place. I will certainly do this day. And that's when he made arrangements for Solomon to ride on the king's horse, to wear the king's robe, and to be marched through the streets with the announcement that King David had chosen Solomon, and Adonijah was short-circuited. He was deposed from his effort to try to become king. The sermonette, we also heard about the prophet Daniel. I put this 3C on my outline of my notes on an example of negative competition. In Daniel 2:4. Now, Daniel was an interesting fellow. He served several kings of different empires. And so when one empire ceased, he was part of the government, the administrative staff. In this case, the new emperor, Darius, the king, came in and said, Well, we got a guy that knows what he's doing here. We'll keep him in place. So here we have then in Daniel 2, verse 48, where Darius noted, it's later it comes to Darius, but first of all, the first king, the king promoted Daniel, the earlier king, promoted Daniel, gave him many gifts, and he made him ruler over the province of Babylon and chief administrator over the wise men. This is when Daniel first ascended in power. And a couple of kings later, Daniel was still favored when the new king Darius took over, and that's in Daniel 6 in verse 1. This was right after the writing, a handwriting on the wall, the famous incident, the Meni Meni Tekla Upharsin, where it was written up on the wall, and Daniel explained what it meant was that you've been found in the balances, or you've been weighed in the balances and found wanting. And sure enough, that night, Darius came in and took over the government, a new kingdom. So Daniel 6, verse 1, it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom, and over these three governors, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account to them so that the king would suffer no loss. The king, meaning Darius, wanted to make sure everything was well taken care of. He didn't want corruption going on. He had a reporting system. So he had 120 reporting to three, and the three reporting to him. Verse 3, and then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps and became because an excellent spirit was in him. We heard about this on our sermon on Pentecost by Mr. Mann. And the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. Now, interesting, number in verse 4, so the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom. But they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful, nor was there an error or fault found on him. Now, why would they want to find fault with Daniel? So here we have people who felt threatened in their lives with regard to their power and authority. They could clearly see they weren't going to advance as long as Daniel was in place. They couldn't expand their power. They couldn't perform corruption. They couldn't lie in their own pockets because Daniel would search them out. He was honest and faithful to the king. So they had to find a way to get rid of Daniel. So we read on in verse 5, and these men said, "We shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God." These men were envious of Daniel. They could not advance their power unless they could diminish Daniel. So they sought a way to bring him down. And to do so, they employed lies and trickery. And we heard some of that in the sermonette. That's an example of negative competition. Now I have in my outline 3D, another example of negative competition would be Mordecai's nemesis, a fellow by the name of Haman. We find this in the book of Esther, starting in Esther in 3:1. Now, Esther, of course, was chosen by King Ahasuerus after he had deposed the previous queen. And his chief advisor, Haman, was promoted. We start that in Esther 3:1, where we can read about how the king promoted Haman. And Haman thought himself to be a pretty big shot, pretty much of a big shot, and wanted everyone to bow to him as if he were the king. But Mordecai, which was Esther's cousin who raised her, an older cousin, after her parents died, the relatives took care of each other. But Mordecai didn't feel like bowing down to Haman, and Haman really didn't much like that. So what did Haman? So Haman thought a way that hurt his pride. So he tried to think of a way to hurt Mordecai to bring him down. Interesting that Haman apparently did not realize that Mordecai was a cousin of Esther. Because if he would have, perhaps the outcome, he would have operated a little differently. But he did not. But he didn't know that. And so Haman sought to destroy, as we read in Esther 3, in verse 5, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. Because if he could destroy them all, Mordecai would be one of them, and then they would all be gone. In Esther 4 and verse 16, this is when Esther, in talking to Mordecai, says, "Here's what I want you to do." Now, this earlier we read in Esther that Mordecai was giving advice to Esther, saying, "You go do this." And now we find Esther, the queen, saying to Mordecai, "I want you to do this." In chapter 4, verse 16, "Go and gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And I will go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." Why is this so important? It's because no one could go before the king unless the king bid them to come. You just didn't show up on the door and say, "Knock, knock, Mr. King, I'm here, I need to have a chat with you." Because that was the death penalty. If the king did not hold out his scepter and grant an audience, then that meant the death penalty. So nobody bothered the king. He would decide with his advisors who could approach the king. And so Esther said, "You know, this is going to require some special effort here." And so, because we are dealing with somebody who is being extraordinarily negative, which is Haman, who wants to kill not just Mordecai, but all the Jews, and that could mean Esther as well. And so this was a horrendous example of where Haman was negatively competing. He wanted the power to himself. He didn't want to dissipate it. He wanted the honor and royalty for himself under the king, Ahasuerus. So in Esther 7 and verse 3, Esther did work up the courage after the prayer and the fasting, and she did approach the king. And then in verse 3, in Esther 7, 3, "And the queen Esther answered and said, 'If I found favor in your sight, O king, and it pleases the king, let my life be given at my petition and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy would never compensate for the king's loss.'" Verse 5, "And Ahasuerus answered and said to the queen, 'Who is he and where is he who would dare to presume in his heart to do such a thing?' And Esther said, "The adversary and the enemy is this wicked Haman." So Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. And the king, and verse 7, and the king rose from his wrath from the banquet and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed and stood before the queen, pleading for his life. For he saw that evil was now determined against him by the king. When the king returned from the palace garden, from the palace of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was, meaning he had fallen down, he was crouching. And the king said, "Will he also assault the queen while I'm here in the house?" So the king didn't like what he saw when Haman was alone with the queen. It was unseemly. That's not something that shouldn't be. And as the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Basically, put a bag over his head. Now, Harbona, one of the eunuchs, said to the king, "Look, the gallows, 50 cubits high, which is 75 feet, which Haman had made for Mordecai, who spoke on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman." And the king said, "Hang him on it." So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's wrath subsided. So we had Haman thought to negatively compete and met for an untimely demise. Now we'll go to positive examples of competition, and there are other negative examples of competition. I'm just giving a few. Let's go to, and I'm going to call this 4A, on a positive example of competition. When Abraham recaptured his nephew Lot, we read this story in Genesis 14 and verse 1, and I'm going to give the short version of it. But they had separated. We talked about it earlier, where Abraham and Lot had separated. One went to the east, one went to the west. And it came to, and as a result, there wasn't strife before Abraham and Lot. And essentially what had happened was, there were five kings that had gotten together, and they had ransacked Sodom and Gomorrah, and they had hauled off whatever they didn't destroy. They hauled off the people and the goods of everything that they could round up and find, and destroyed as much as they could. And that included Lot and Lot's family and Lot's possessions. And what was Abraham's response here to this to his family being kidnapped and all of their sustenance stolen? And in a nutshell, Abraham then took chapter 14, we read that Abraham had 318 mounted horsemen that were on Abraham's servants or his employees. These were mounted and armed horsemen. Now, let's stop and think about how many 318 is. That's a lot of horses to begin with. That means they had more horses than that, and that's how many horsemen that they had. And the horsemen weren't alone. That means they all had saddles, they all had bridles, they all had armor. They were armed. In other words, Abraham had his own small army there, and they could move very fast. They weren't on foot. They were on horses, so they could move very rapidly. And they chased those five, as we read in Genesis 14. They chased those five kings and ran them down and recaptured Lot and his family and all of those goods, as we read through that in Genesis 14. And when we read down to, go ahead off to chapter 13, or to verse 13. "And one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt near the trees of Mamre." And moving on down, now when Abram heard that his brother, meaning his relative, male relative, was taken captive, he armed his 318 trained servants, so they knew what they were doing. It wasn't like some of us who hadn't been on a horse before or never handled a weapon. These were all trained, who were born in his own house, and they went in pursuit as far as Dan. Genesis 14:15. "He divided his forces against them by night, and he and his servants attacked them and pursued them. north of Damascus. That's a long ways from that. And he brought back all of the goods, and he brought back Lot, his brother, and his goods, as well as the women and the people. He wasn't going to let them get away with it. So he competed positively in that sense to rescue his relatives. And now in my outline, under 4b, we have the example of David and Goliath. We read this story in 1 Samuel 17, 1. And we know this story about the Philistines were gathered, and they had a champion named Goliath in 1 Samuel 17. And this Goliath was a height was 6 cubits, that's about, and a span, so that'd be what, 6 times 18 inches is about 9 feet tall, plus a little more, a hand span, so maybe 9.5 feet tall. He was a big guy, he was their champion. And he would shout out saying, "Choose a man for yourselves and have him come down and fight me." Verse 9, "If he's able to fight and kill me, then we'll be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you'll be our servants and you will serve us." And the Philistine, verse 10, said, "And I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." Well, this didn't set well when young David came to visit his brothers who were in the army. And the men were saying, you know, what the king Saul said is, anybody who can defeat this Goliath, I will exempt his family from taxes. Well, that's a pretty big deal. Pay no taxes. And I'll give him the king's daughter, which is a pretty big deal. And so David said, "Who is this person who profanes the God of Israel?" And so at that point, we know the story. The rest is history. David knew that God was with him, and he wasn't afraid to directly compete with Goliath because he knew that God was with him. In my outline under 4C, we have the example of Elijah on Mount Carmel. I'm not going to go through all of it, but basically it was a time in the northern tribes when there was a great famine. There was a confrontation between the prophets of Baal and Elijah, and they're saying, "Who is God? Which one is more powerful?" And so Elijah says, well, let's hear. We're in 1 Kings 18. Let's have a little contest. You want to compete? We'll let you compete with God if you want to. And so they built an altar and said, "Okay, this is a drought, but we don't have much water, but we'll take plenty of water and we'll pour it over this altar and we'll do a sacrifice, but no fair lighting of fire. We'll have to let your God can light the fire if he can." Well, first of all, Elijah, he let them have a dry altar. He didn't pour any water on theirs, but they called all day and called all night. And so it was, it's verse 27 in 1 Kings 18. And it was at noon, and Elijah mocked them, saying, "Cry aloud, for he is a god, or he is meditating, or maybe he's busy or on a journey. Perhaps he's sleeping and must be awakened." In fact, if you take a look, when you see, I believe the word meditating is a polite way of saying, perhaps he's sitting on the toilet somewhere and he can't come right now. So he was not being very, you know, Elijah was pretty much saying, you know, if you're God, be a God, you know, let him perform, let him do his thing. And midday was past, verse 29. And they prophesied until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, but there was no voice, no one answered, and no one paid attention. We read on in verse 30 and thereafter, where Elijah said, put water on this, do it again, you know, make sure it's plenty wet. And God responded. It's really, frankly, the message there is it's really rather foolish to attempt to compete with God. It's not going to turn out well for someone that attempts to do that. So the story of Esther, as I have it down in 4C, and we've already told the story of Esther, is that she competed positively for the attention of the king. Had she chosen to just do nothing, then the outcome may have been very different. So we've already gone through that on Esther. So how to apply then these principles? We've seen negative examples positive examples of cooperation, negative examples of cooperation. We've seen negative examples of competition. We've seen positive examples of competition. How to understand these principles? Well, I turn to Proverbs 26, verses 4 and 5. And this comes to mind when you're faced with tough choices. In Proverbs 26, verse 4 and 5, in verse 4, it's, "Do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you also be like him." Or verse 5, "Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes." There comes a time when you have to decide, based on the circumstances, what the best course of action is. Sometimes it's better to sit and wait. Sometimes it's better to say nothing. Sometimes it would be best to cooperate. Sometimes it would be best to compete and not allow whatever it is to take advantage of you. We have many other examples of in the Bible on how to make competition in the Bible. We have the parable of the sower in Luke 8, and I won't go through it all, but Luke 8 about how the good seed was sown, and yet in some of the ground grew up with weeds and thistles and thorns and made it difficult, because the good crops compete with the weeds. And that's the way life is in this world. And if some of you remember, if you've ever watched the Indiana Jones movie, The Last Crusade, there was the hero of the movie who was Indiana Jones. And he was attempting to retrieve the Holy Grail, that cup that supposedly was there at the Last Supper of Christ's Last Supper during the New Testament Passover before his crucifixion. And according to the movie, and of course it is just a Hollywood movie, the Holy Grail was being guarded by the medieval knight who had lived 1,000 years. And movies can do this, you know. And as one of the three knights that were dedicated to protecting the cup, and all who came to retrieve that cup were slain or chose the wrong cup from the many that were displayed. And as the hero of the movie, Indiana Jones, finally made it to the chamber where the Holy Grail was being protected by the old medieval knight, Indiana Jones found many cups to choose from. Another person, an enemy of Indiana Jones, who had also made it to the chamber where the Holy Grail was displayed, also found many cups to choose from. But the enemy eagerly chose the fanciest, finest, most bejeweled cup, the most decorated cup, and seized it as his prize. And as this Hollywood movie goes, the enemy combatant who seized the bejeweled cup then died. And the knight protecting the cup remarked, "He chose poorly." Well, the hero, Indiana Jones, chose one of the cups that he thought was the Holy Grail, and he chose a plain cup that he thought would be used by a carpenter in the first century. And the knight protecting the cup said, "You chose wisely." Well, that's our task, is to choose wisely when faced with difficult decisions. That's the purpose God is working out on earth, for us to learn to make godly decisions. So each day we will see positive examples of cooperation, and we should follow those examples. And when we see negative examples of cooperation, we should avoid those. And when we see negative examples of competition, we should avoid those. And when we see positive examples of competition, we should embrace those. Because there's times when it's important to cooperate, to work with others, to achieve a noble purpose, and times to avoid the cooperation with others when we perceive the results of that cooperation do not work to a godly purpose. And there are times when we should avoid competition in order to promote harmony and peace. And there are times when we should embrace competition as a tool to bring out the best in ourselves and others, to reach for and attain the prize. In the final analysis, it's not the tool that you use, but how you use the tool. Our prayers to God should include asking for wisdom and discernment to know how and when to cooperate and how and when to compete.